Okay, welcome everyone to our next Thrive Together gathering. Thank you so much for taking a Saturday to do this. What a time we are in. I don't know that there's ever been a more exciting time to be alive, a more risky time. And at the same time, I don't know that there's ever been a time in human history when a single person could make a bigger difference in the world. And that applies to each one of us. So the Pope and all the top so-called leaders are in New York. The stock markets and various economies across the globe are teetering. There are currency wars and saber rattling and refugees fleeing. Elections are gearing up all over the planet. El Nino is coming north. More and more talk and evidence of various ET politics and dynamics going on all over the earth. So it's quite a time. And this is, to us, a perfect time to just come together, not just for a data dump, but for a think tank with you. You know, this is not a blog. We're going to present some information and some of our perspectives on it. But then really what we do these events for is to get to converse with you, to hear what you think is going on, what your evaluation assessment of it is. What does this all mean? You know, what are your questions? What are your sources saying? So we're going to get into all of that in a moment. But before we get started, I want to turn it over to Kimberly for a few brief moments to give you some guidelines and announcements for the event. So Kimberly, take it away.
All right. Welcome, everybody. It's a pleasure to be with you. We really look forward to this. I wanted to say that you're being recorded. So when we might make highlights available from this. And so I just want to make sure you know that. And also, I wanted to say for anybody who might have technical problems with you, register early. It really helps to get those solved ahead of time. And I also wanted to mention that the comments on the portal page of Thrive Together, it's great if you put your comments and topics you want us to be addressing and questions there. We had some great questions this last time that we'll be addressing today. And I just want to encourage that and also the evaluations at the end of this, because it really helps us to be more responsive to what it is you want to be doing here. So use the chat for comments and to share resources with each other, and the Q&A to have questions and comments directly to us. And if you have tech issues, please write to Mitch, and the way to reach him is events@thrivemovement.com. And last time, everybody who wrote to him also wrote back when the problem was solved, and it was so satisfying. So encourage you again, if you have an issue and he helps you solve it, let him know so it's not just lingering there and we don't know whether or not it was handled or not. So the other thing is, when you put a comment or resource into chat, be sure to put it to all participants. You'll have a choice between private and all participants to do that. And Go is the one who will help you get up on video. We love it when you show up on video so that we can all see each other, and it just feels more like we're, you know, not just disembodied voices. So to do that, Goa will make you a panelist, and then after you exit the full screen mode, look for your name in the participants panel, and then click on the little green icon that's next to your name. And that will start your video, and then Goa will unmute you. And if you can get your camera up and running in advance, it'll save us all time. And it's still the case that WebEx has not managed to get certain things mobile friendly. So the polls, we just have one poll today, but those on mobile devices, just think of the answer in your head, and or you could type it into the chat section if there's something that you really want us to know, or to the Q&A for us. Anyway, that's it. I'm really looking forward to today, and so go for it, Foster.
Okay. A couple of more things I want to do before we just thoroughly dive in the deep end here. And the first one is just to set a little context. As I mentioned, all of these events are think tanks. They're about different issues each month, but the thread moving through all of them is that they're always about developing the skills and tools for more critical thinking. And as we're talking about various current events today, a key, I think, sort of overview is the question, how do we evaluate alternative news sources? And this is something that we're continuing to learn about. I'm sure that you are, and we can help each other. So I want to share my screen for a moment. Goa, if you could give me that capability. Okay. Okay, here's a little list of some of the things that we have found really helpful in evaluating alternative news sources. And I want to go over this list briefly with you and then invite you during the course of the event to add any ones that you have, any kind of tips on how you evaluate sources. And then also feel free to put into chat your favorite source or two, so that then other people can benefit from that. So the first one in our list is we look for a track record of accuracy from any source. And no matter what, how reliable they are, we look to corroborate the facts that they're claiming with other sources as well. Then we look to what are their sources of funding? You know, who do they have to answer to financially? Obviously, that affects mainstream media hugely in terms of advertisers. Also, what is their political affiliation? Obviously, that goes very closely with the previous one. So is there a particular agenda that's going to shape what they say, what they're willing to say, and what they're unwilling to say? Next one is there a personal risk or gain to the reporter that helps us evaluate what kind of motivation they have? Are they really willing to take a risk to tell the truth, or are they more apt to be playing it safe and just sticking within a certain accepted set of information? The next one, and a big one, is consistency of logic. You know, even amongst our Thrive team here in between Kimberly and me, we're constantly challenging each other on any claims of, okay, does this make sense? Not does it fit in with a traditional worldview, but if it extends beyond that, does it follow logic? Does it seem like it could happen as well as the evidence that it is happening? The next one is the emotional tone. And this is something I know that a lot of people consider this, particularly when listening to people like Alex Jones or David Icke. Some people are turned off by an emotional urgency or a shrill tone or something like that. And it's an important one to keep in mind, but at the same time, just as important not to be turned off by the tone of a voice if the information seems really valid and critical. It would have been a shame, you know, when Paul Revere ran through the colonies if people didn't pay attention to him because his voice was too loud or something like that. Okay, then we ask ourselves, how close is the source to the actual event? How many steps removed is this report coming? And finally, how objective does the reporter seem to be in looking at all sides of an issue, in looking for the truth rather than social acceptability or political acceptability or just minimization of risk? So, okay, I wanted to just put that up there and again invite you to put your favorite source and any additional tips that you can think of into our chat. Okay, Goa, let's go back to you and we'll dive into the first poll. So what we want to do before deciding kind of how much time to spend on different things here is we want to ask you, of the items that we put on our infographic on the flyer for today's event, how do you rate your interest in these different issues? So if you have that poll in front of you, just click on two of these current events to indicate your preference. A is, what about the U.S. presidential election? B is, what's going on with the U.S. and Chinese stock markets? C see is what is likely to happen with interest rates and quantitative easing, that's Fed money fabrication, and what would be the impacts of these two things. D is what's going on with the currency wars among the U.S., China, and Russia. And finally, what about current hotspots for new or growing wars, things like Korea, Syria, the South China Sea, Ukraine, you know, it goes on to Yemen and on and on. So click on two of those and hit submit down in the lower right, and we'll kind of see what your preferences are for today.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean we won't touch on the others. It just lets us know what your orientation and interest is in particular.
Okay, Goa, how are we doing on submissions for that?
It's almost done. Okay, I can show the results now.
Okay, and when you're looking at these results, remember if you go just to the right of the tab where it says questions and just click on that little vertical line and then pull that to the right, that allows you to see more of the actual question. Okay, so remember, some people aren't able to answer this if they're on mobile devices, so it looks like 15 people were unable to answer. It looks like what's going on with the currency wars is top choice, then current hotspots for a war, followed by what's going on with the U.S. and Chinese stock markets, and then the interest rates and QE, and finally the presidential elections. Okay, well, that I'm going to make a little screen grab of this so I can refer to that as we do our time and questions here. Okay, that's very helpful. Thanks for doing that. So it seems like the place to start in is with these currency wars and stock markets. So let me just share a little bit of my research and my kind of knitting together of the various information that I've found. The deeper I go into this, the more the story becomes clearer. You know, we're very clear that no one, much less us, ever really knows everything that's going on and how these pieces fit together. But there are some things which kind of become obvious over time. We can speculate, and then the evidence starts to build, and it starts to get pretty clear. So let's look at a few things. Guess I want to start with a timeline that may help kind of put together the narrative here. In July this past summer, the Chinese stock market dropped by around 30%, 24 to 30% over the month, and there have been several other adjustments in the meantime. So that caused concern around the world, especially with the U.S. And then on August 7th, the IMF, very much influenced and pressured by the U.S., told China that their currency, which is officially the renminbi, but you'll usually hear it talked about as the yuan. There's a lot of confusion about that. Basically, the renminbi is the abstraction of the Chinese currency. That's like talking about the abstraction of height, where in height, the unit of account might be inches or centimeters. In currency, the abstraction of the renminbi is counted in units of the yuan. So generally speaking, most people just refer to the yuan because that's what's most used, and also it's easier to pronounce. So China was told that their currency was not going to be accepted into the basket of internationally accepted currencies, which is something that they have been lobbying for a long time. It's something that they've deserved for a long time. You know, originally the the currency was considered to be too weak and too rigorously controlled by the government to be eligible for to be a real free market internationally traded currency. Well, now the Chinese economy has passed the U.S. to become the strongest in the world, and a number of the events that we're going to go into have been loosening up the control, the manipulation of the currency by the Chinese government. And interestingly enough, that really goes back to mostly pressure from the U.S. because the dollar has been the currency of international trade. So the Chinese government was really hoping to get that inclusion in the basket of currencies really right now, this fall. They were hoping to get that because that would allow so much. It would allow their currency to really float, and it would also allow them to begin releasing much of their wealth into the world for humanitarian projects. We've been told by multiple representatives from the Asian Dragon family that's the main thing, the so-called global currency reset, where all of the different currencies, the major currencies around the world, have to basically, what they call in the market, mark to market. They actually need to be reevaluated based on the real assets and services that they have, the strength of the economy, their reserves, their resources, and all that type of thing. The U.S. hasn't wanted that to happen for obvious reasons. We've been, you know, losing so much of our market share in various markets. It's questionable how much gold we have left at all. And the government is hugely in debt. Most of the major banks are, you know, hundreds of trillions of dollars in derivatives debt. So we're kind of running on fumes and keeping the interest rates low to try to kind of hide that fact, keep gold from taking off, and try to protect the kind of domination of the dollar. But back to our timeline. Okay, so not too long after this, in fact, about 4 days later on August 11th, China devalues the yuan by 1.9%. Interesting number because the U.S. allows them to raise or lower their currency only by 2% daily. So obviously they were going up to just below that. And they just even that sent shockwaves around the world and set off a kind of a cascading impact on the U.S. economy. Interestingly enough, the very next day, there was an explosion that you may have heard about, still really unexplained, at a chemical factory at a port called Tianjin in China. Some people are claiming that they saw this column of light coming down from the sky. There's long been rumored that the U.S. has what they call a rod of God, a space weapon. Some people think that that's what caused this. It left an anomalous crater and took out six city blocks. Still unexplained. I don't know what actually caused that, but there's lots of speculation that China had been warned not to take these financial steps. And as soon as they did, this happened. Now, does that sound like just some wild conspiracy theory? Maybe, until you look to see that in China was warned one previous time not to do this in 2008, to do certain financial moves. They were warned by the U.S. that the U.S. would hit them with an earthquake if they did. Well, sure enough, they took the actions, and in Sichuan province in 2008, there was an earthquake that seems to have been generated by HAARP, the auroral antenna up in Alaska. Again, does that sound like some crazy speculation? Well, HAARP has claimed that they're able to cause earthquakes, and the HAARP signal, when concentrated, creates oftentimes a certain kind of rainbow effect in the atmosphere. Well, there's plenty of YouTube videos on the internet showing exactly those rainbow effects about 15 minutes before the quake hit. And also there's other data showing that HAARP was geared up to its highest level right before the earthquake hit. A similar thing happened in Haiti. You know, Japan has claimed that they've been threatened similarly if they take certain economic steps, that they would be earthquaked. And maybe it's coincidence that there was a so-called earthquake. potentially created by an underground nuclear explosion that caused the tsunami in Japan. And Hugo Chavez in Venezuela was threatened that they would get him if he sold oil without using the dollar and, you know, sold to China and so forth. And he went ahead and did that and then died mysteriously of cancer, which is exactly what it's well documented that the U.S. was planning to do to Castro. So just time to knit together some of the larger perspective on these seemingly isolated events. So the China devalued the yuan. So what's the effect of that? Well, for them, it allows them to stabilize what was a dropping GDP and to scrape a lot of inflation out of their economy, as Russia was able to do when it dropped the ruble. You know, it looks like bad news at first when a currency gets inflated. I mean, gets deflated, but if it's been deflated, that's actually nature taking over. So the deflation actually allows them to increase their exports as well, because goods are cheaper coming from China with the lowered currency. It also allows them to position themselves even better for the coming global currency reset. And again, this has been mentioned all the way to the top, even by Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, this imminent reset. Okay, so China has actually referred to this devaluation not as a currency war, but as what they call exchange rate liberalization. It's basically beginning to free up the Chinese economy from U.S. domination, and they've been taking lots of steps in that regard, as have other countries, especially in the BRICS alliance. So it allows the yuan to float more freely against the dollar and to help establish the yuan as a global reserve currency. The Bank of China itself said, quote, "This will allow the markets to have more influence over the yuan exchange rate." In other words, this is what the free market actually is supposed to be doing. But as I mentioned, the U.S. has lots of reasons why they don't want this to happen. A rise in the interest rates of the U.S. would expose U.S. government and banking insolvency, and this would pave the way for the revaluation of the dollar down and other currencies that the U.S. is trying to prevent or at least continue to stall their revaluations. So, mind you, this is not the end of revaluation of the yuan. Chinese economists say their currency has been undervalued against the dollar between 15 and 40% for many years. And it's rumored that China is pushing for at least a 10% overall devaluation of the yuan. Now, financial expert Peter Schiff, who is well known for having accurately predicted both the 2008 crash and previously the 2001 tech bubble crash. He has been saying very clearly, he said, don't think China is responsible for the crash recently in the U.S. stock market. It has to do with the actions of the Federal Reserve. He says the Chinese economy is far more dynamic and powerful than the U.S. Now, to the rest of us, this should actually be pretty obvious if we look, because of the differing growth rates in each economy and the fact that China is our major creditor, the major creditor really on the planet, and while the U.S. is the biggest debtor in human history. And that's obviously not sustainable in a personal life or ultimately with nation states. Over the summer, China reported that they had accumulated another 600 tons of gold, increasing their supposed holdings to around 1,600 tons. I think that was done very carefully, just enough to indicate that they're ready to play with the big boys in terms of gold reserves, but not enough to panic the world markets. You know, even traditional analysts say that China has been buying gold at least 600 tons a month. 600 tons every 3 months. The number is probably a lot higher of what they're holding, and many put the estimates even traditionally, at 10,000 tons or more. Now, to put that in context, the IMF says they hold 90.5 tons. The U.S. says it holds 8,133 tons. And the U.S. has not been honoring requests for repatriation of gold from, you know, back in the 70s with Nixon when he went off the gold standard because we couldn't pay back France. And recently Germany requested their gold back and they gave them less than 10% and said maybe in 2020 they'd get some more. And the Dragon family had loaned a tremendous amount of gold to the U.S. Over the course of about 40, 50 years, and it was due to be repaid, I've talked about this before, on September 12th, 2001, the day after what happened with the Twin Towers. And don't think that was any coincidence, and a lot of the paperwork for all that was held in the basement of Building 7, the one that came down without being hit by anything. So, in addition to all those numbers, I think anyone who has been following the history of the Asian Dragon Alliance probably has a pretty strong sense that these estimates for the holdings of China are ridiculously low. They have been gathering gold from around the world. They've been buying. They have huge veins that they have been mining and supposedly not reporting for centuries. And they have been playing the long game. To be in a position of optimal strength when the world goes to an asset-backed financial system. And it looks like that's going to be happening soon, and they will obviously be in a very strong position. Now, when the U.S. has been blaming China for cybersecurity breaches, for devaluing their currency, et cetera, and when they encouraged the IMF to not let the yuan become a global currency, that was a major stirring of the hornet's nest. You know, that was poking the dragon right in the eye. And that's a real, you know, it can be a very humiliating thing for a very proud people who've been working hard on building their economy and taking care of their people. And so retaliation could be expected for that, especially in terms of devaluation of the currency, which has happened, and ultimately a dumping of U.S. treasuries. In other words, beginning to withdraw from buying the loans of the U.S. treasury. So sure enough, recently China dumped over $100 billion in U.S. treasuries in 2 days, and it looks like that's just the beginning. In addition, one more piece of this puzzle is that China has $21 trillion in currency reserve, in sovereign resource reserves, and they are in a position to invest that in the U.S. and other countries, and they're very actively doing that investing all over the world right now. In addition, 19 countries at least so far have already switched from dollar to national currencies for energy purposes. So what will happen next? We've laid out various possible scenarios in previous blogs that we've done, but to sum it up very simply, from my perspective, it's either the U.S. is willing to collaborate with the BRICS alliances and the rest of the world and become a partner in a healthy, honest economy globally, or we will be isolated, and it will spell at least short-term catastrophe for the West as the dollar drops. The Dragon family has offered to back the U.S. dollar with its gold. If we don't accept that and the rest of the world goes to asset-backed currencies, it's obviously going to put us in third world status very quickly and isolated from the rest of the world. So it's really it's a paradigm moment. You know, can the status in so-called in charge here be wise and humble enough to actually partner with the rest of the world, or does this macho need to dominate spell catastrophe for the West? Okay, let me see if I have anything else I wanted to cover for. Let's look at the stock markets for a moment. That was the other strong one. When the Chinese stock market dropped, it was portrayed in the U.S. as see how weak the Chinese economy is. And then when our market dropped, you know, the usual pundits, particularly in mainstream, were very quick to blame China for it. Well, that doesn't kind of jive with reality. What happened in China when their market dropped, you know, approximately 25%, was considered a correction in our market. Their stock market had been up 149% in the prior year. So that's a net 125% gain for the last year in their stock market. That's, of course, not mentioned in the Wall Street Journal. So what did China do about that? They created an alliance of brokerage firms that put close to $20 billion in a fund to buy stocks. They relaxed restrictions on buying, and they created a moratorium on IPOs. Now, do I think that's a great idea? No, those aren't free market activities. But China still has a very dominant government, and they needed to stem the fall of the economy to keep the confidence of their people. And so they took these actions, and it has at least stalled that correction. As in this country, China and every other country, I think, will ultimately need to go to the free market, which is what built the financial strength of the U.S., when it was a more free market, and which also saved the economy of China from the disasters of communism under Mao, which had really essentially destroyed the economy. So we're taking steps all over the world toward a more free economy, but clearly we're not there yet.
Foster, what is the IMF refusing to have China's currency, in the basket of globally traded currencies? What does that have to do with other countries actually using the yuan and trading with it? Like, what determines that?
Well, as far as I know, they're not able to condoned in doing international transactions in yuan. That's supposed to be still all in the dollar. And the China representatives from China have told you and me that they're waiting until the yuan is freely and legally exchanged everywhere on the planet, the way that the dollar is now, or at least was. Vladimir Putin has actually drafted a new law eliminating the ability to trade with the U.S. dollar or the euro between what they call CIS countries. Those are the former USSR countries. So these are the kind of currency battles that are going on. And it's all the shenanigans that go on when you don't have a free market. You know, in my opinion, statism, which is what all the elections are about, is to elect status, people supposedly to rule us. Statism always leads to the taking over of a natural economy and the destruction thereof. Central planning has never worked for an economy. But when the status take over the economy, then they can, through taxes, take your money to go off and wage wars, and they know they're going to need it. They're both for imperialism, and when their economy collapses, war is usually the last resort. So that cascade from statism to economic failure to war is what we're seeing played out over and over again around the world. And what happens usually is there's some kind of revolution or a regime change, but the new regime comes in with a statist regime, and the same cascade starts again. Now, I'm not going to go too deeply into that today. We'll be covering that. We've covered it in past blogs, and Kimberly and I are writing a whole book on that right now, how to actually free up sovereign individuals and free up economies around the world by moving to a truly free world. And I've got a blog coming out next week that also lays out the stages of that as we touched on in the film.
Can I add one thing here, Foster,
sure.
On the China currency? You know, so as Foster mentioned, when we had an opportunity to talk directly with the elders, representatives from the Chinese Dragon family, and got this information that they really were waiting for the yuan to be a globally traded currency for these other resets to happen. And the resets were a lot like, you know, in Vietnam, where the currency got suppressed a long time ago with the war. We just, you know, demolished that country, suppressed the currency. And now, you know, you see Vietnam flourishing as a country, but the currency is still suppressed from the old days. So the notion of these revaluations is to, you know, have currencies like Vietnam's, which should be higher, America's, which has been falsely inflated all this time and would naturally be lower. Anyway, this kind of revaluation, they wanted to wait. And I think since it seemed to me that this whole thing about devaluing their yuan was to get them further into the globally traded market. More exports because it's cheaper to buy their goods with the yuan down. So even though they're not officially in the basket of internationally traded currencies, they're still increasing their global spread and people participating with the yuan and just better positioning themselves so that whether it's, you know, the end of 2016, I think was the prediction about when the IMF would say they could be in the basket of currencies, but meanwhile, they're just doing this very strategic, you know, move to get their currency out there anyway. And that's one of the things about China that I've noticed is they really do slow strategic moves. You know, if something takes a year, that's nothing in China time. For how long this stuff has been in the works. So when I saw the devaluation of the yuan, I thought my reaction was, oh, that's a smart way for them to get to increase their exports, which positions them better for this being traded internationally. So I just wanted to add that that was my take on what was happening there, even though they're not in that basket officially.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I want to add a little bit more to that also, to expand on what you were saying about the creating the alternatives. The BRICS alliance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, has been clearly creating alternatives to the Rothschild, Rockefeller, banking cabal, Federal Reserve system, which has been destroying the environment, is destroying economies all over the world. And we were told by a high-ranking member of the Dragon family last spring that in fact the money that most of the money that the Federal Reserve and the IMF and the World Bank were using was borrowed from the Asians against their gold troves. And then the same person told us in the spring that because of the misbehavior, the catastrophes that the Federal Reserve has been creating, and the fact that they haven't been paying back even the interest on those debts, that the Dragon family was going to disenfranchise the Federal Reserve's capability to print money. Now, that was a really big claim last March, I think it was. And a month later, then Fed Chairman Bernanke announced the end of quantitative easing, which shocked the world and was further confirmation for us that these people that we're talking to from Asia do in fact know a lot about what they're talking about, not just because of their research, but because they're in the thick of this. And they're actually in a very pivotal role. So they have, from what we've been told, and the evidence seems to back it up, they have no interest whatsoever in creating World War III. So they have been creating the alternatives. They've been inviting the U.S. into a good deal, you know, a soft landing, and meanwhile creating an alternative gold exchange and the alternative, you know, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the the Asian Development Bank. And, you know, other countries are invited into this, and, you know, many, many of them are joining, but the U.S. Has stayed away. But meanwhile, they've also been creating an alternative internet. And we were told that they have created an alternative, what they call a SWIFT system, which is International Electronic Transfer for Funds, which is now used all over the globe, and it's run and controlled in a very manipulative ways by the Federal Reserve. So, of course, it's been difficult for the Asian elders to move significant funds for humanitarian purposes because it had to be moved through the Federal Reserve SWIFT system, and it has been stalled, it's been stolen along the way. So they stopped trying to do that until there's an alternative system in place or until the U.S. is willing to allow a free flow of funds. And so we were told publicly I saw an article saying, well, in September or October, that will be released at the end of 2015 at the earliest. And what we were told by the Dragon family was it was actually finished in the spring and is gradually starting to be used. So, you know, this is a major shift in power over the economy globally. Now, I found a couple of quotes that were at least good news. I don't know whether to for sure believe them or not, but it's what I want to hear. First of all, because we have to ask ourselves the question, if China is going to be in this powerful a position in the world, if they hold most of the world's wealth and they're, you know, such a significant leader in the BRICS alliance and the Western empire is falling, well, are we just going to go into the next new global regime, you know, under the thumb of China? And, you know, I think we need to be very wary about that. But I found an article where they interviewed this man named Professor General Liu Mingfu, and he declared that there are no imperialist intentions. He said China has been invaded 470 times between 1840 and 1905. And the people there know that that doesn't feel good. It ultimately doesn't work. It destroys cultures. It destroys human lives and certainly destroys stability. President Xi Jinping recently said, you know, China is not trying to rearrange the architecture of global governance. Instead, he said that should be decided by all countries. So I'm not going to get into the whole notion of global governance, but at least having all countries participate in the conversation and being free and sovereign is a major step toward individual sovereignty across the world. Okay, I think that's I'm thinking, Kimberly, and to give me your input on this, I'm thinking maybe we ought to pause there. And before going into a description of some of the research about what's going on in potential hotspots for war, obviously all the currency and market stuff is an important catalyst toward that. But I'm thinking maybe we should just pause for more interactivity now and kind of focus the conversation on the whole financial aspect. And then I can come back in a little later and talk about, give a little download on some information on hotspots, and then open it up after that for more conversation about the likelihood of war and the impacts in different countries around the world and so forth. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that's good. We've got some good questions coming in and comments, so I think let's interact some on those and then dive into the next, just because, right. I think, you know, I mean, obviously there's so much in this, but let's see if maybe Bren Hudson can come on up, and also Bruce Tanner.
Bren, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. I don't know how to make the video work.
Okay.
If you see your name in the participants list,
Okay.
Click on the button next to your name that is a green icon, a little video.
Participants list, okay.
Participants panel.
I've seen my name in the past, but I don't see it right now.
Tell her where the participants list is. She might be in full screen.
Right, or if you're in full screen mode, then you need to pick the panelist list from the green menu bar at the top. If you're in non-full screen mode, then it should be on the right-hand side under the video feed.
Wow, I am so sorry that I'm not really seeing this. Okay. So let me ask my question. My question is, I'm a little confused by why we're turning to at least understanding the macroeconomics of what's going on with China and Russia, but particularly today China, that they've been or they are communist countries, and ours is supposedly not that. I'm a little confused by that, and I wanted to get some clarification on that. Did that question make sense, and did you hear it?
Foster, you must be on mute or something.
Go ahead.
So the question, Bren, is why are we looking to communist countries for guidance or partnership in the financial realms?
Yeah, it is. I'm struggling to understand that, actually.
Yeah. No, it's a great question, and it's one that I've wrestled with for years. And so I'll go into a little bit the whole question of statism. This is what my entire blog is on that's coming out next week. So I won't spend too much time on it. But the key point that I would want to make is as soon as we empower a few individuals to take everybody else's money and decide what to do with it, the first thing they're going to do is protect their own power. The next thing they usually do is expand their power. And
that doesn't matter what system you're in, does it?
That's right. You look at the history of so-called democratic nations as they get more and more powerful. It's the same thing. And one shocking realization for me was, a while ago, I just really studied socialism and communism and fascism. So I read the major books, I read the Communist Manifesto and I read the Mao's Little Green Book and on and on. And I came to realize that of the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto, the U.S. has already incorporated, I would say, 7. And Obama and Bernie Sanders and others are working very hard on bringing in the other 3. So one of the main things I realized is that whether you start with communism or socialism or fascism or democracy, they're all giving your power over to, at best, majority rule. And that's assuming honest elections. But it's still, mob rule. So there's a dynamic that happens where even when you start with a democracy, the people in power tend to want to go very quickly to socialism, and they use taking care of the people as an excuse for that. Now, I am all for people being taken care of, but if it's done coercively, you've planted the seeds of tyranny. And Mao, in his Little Red Book, describes very clearly and repeatedly that his goal was to socialize China, to prepare it for communism. So in socialism, socialism means that the means of production and services are owned by the state. Now, supposedly for we the people. But the bottom line is, and you look at the history of socialism, that it ends up being controlled by a very few, and people don't end up being taken care of, because the socialism goes quickly to communism. What communism is it gets rid of any private property at all. and gets rid of freedom of religion and so forth. And that is, so it's a slippery slope from democracy to social democracy to socialism to communism to complete economic disaster and usually, you know, millions of people murdered, wars, you know, the whole catastrophe of human civilization. So I am not looking to communism for advice. I've studied China intensely over the last year and a half, and they're facing their own predicament. Some call it the Chinese dilemma, because under Mao, they had complete communism. They still have a communist dictatorship, but they saved their country by allowing in enough free market entrepreneurship to generate a lot of wealth, a lot of progress, a lot of development within their country. And now they're reaching that critical threshold where they have quite an entrepreneurial, you know, brilliant populace who has caught on to creativity and caught on to freedom and collaboration, you know, voluntary collaboration. So they are straining under the dilemma of trying to keep a communist dictatorship lid over a booming, somewhat free market economy. So I think that the, you know, the future of China, and to a great extent the future of the world, is going to be resolving this dilemma. In China now, they're calling it democratic dictatorship. If that doesn't sound Orwellian, and the other term for it is authoritarian capitalism. Now, David Rockefeller loved that term, and we, you know, we have his quote in Thrive praising, you know, that Mao's experiment is one of the most successful in human history. And if you look to the New World Order, of which David Rockefeller is one of the main architects, this is exactly what they want. This is the privatization of profit, you know, taking advantage of the free market for the financial elite. But then when you have losses, like your bank is in debt, you need bailouts, or your big company is failing, so you want to claim that you're too big to fail, or you want to do a war, but you know you'll never get the people to pay for it, and you don't want to pay for it yourself, so you just start printing money. This is the privatization of profits and the socialization of losses that has our grandchildren already in debt to the tune of $350,000 per person. And they're not even, you know, for the ones who aren't even born yet, they're already in that kind of debt under so-called government. But, you know, we've done another blog on the fact that the U.S. and most other countries are actually covert corporations, all, you know, all indebted to the various banking regimes around the world. So what? So let me add one more piece. So this, it's such a critical question, and I'm glad that you brought it up. You know, we have studied the Dragon family for quite a while, and then were contacted by a number of different members, either representatives, you know, agents of the family, but then we've also been invited to meet with high-ranking members of the family. So it's an opportunity to, it's just an incredible privilege to begin sharing worldviews and getting to know the actual human beings and trying to assess, okay, what do they say? And what do we sense is their real agenda? And
let me interrupt, because some people don't know who the Dragon family is, and we have a lot of questions in here saying, can you just give a little context before you get into more of this? That would be helpful.
Yeah, thank you. I recommend for anyone who wants to read a real kind of Tom Clancy, James Bond, page turner that actually is true, buy a book called The Gold Warriors. This is a well-documented book that gives you a window into what they call Yamashita's gold. It's the gold troves owned by the Japanese royal families that were hidden at the end of World War II so they wouldn't be stolen. And this gives you just a little glimpse of the vast troves of gold that are controlled by Asian royal families. But that's just Japan. It goes on to include China, Indonesia, the Philippines, and Vietnam. And there may be more, but I know that those ones are involved. And they have been collecting and stewarding gold for millennia. but especially in the last few centuries. And they have been waiting in recent times, they have been waiting to be in a position where it's safe enough and there is the infrastructure to use that wealth, which we've been told is over 90% of the wealth of the world. This is not the gold that's, if you Google, you know, global gold holdings, this won't show up. It's many, many, many times that. But they have been waiting. This is what we've been told. And it seems they're like their actions are aligning, and ultimately we'll see that they have a spiritual covenant amongst themselves with their people and with this gold. Whereas the Western banking cabal, their covenant seems to be amongst themselves, just devoted to profit and to controlling the world. What we've been told is the Dragon Alliance, their spiritual covenant is to protect and promote the spiritual well-being of their families, of their people, and of the world. And I don't know the exact number, but a vast percentage of this wealth cannot be used unless it's given away or loaned out or invested or whatever for humanitarian purposes. And so they have been actively involved in sending agents all over the world to find the best humanitarian projects. And you can find more in-depth detail on this in some of our old blogs on this topic. But what they have been doing is waiting until they were in a safe enough position where they couldn't just be invaded and have this treasure stolen, as has happened in Iraq. When the people think that, you know, that was for, you know, regime change and making the country safe for democracy. Well, a lot of people weren't told about the fact that the first thing they did was steal all their the Western powers did was steal the gold. Second thing they did was institute a Rothschild banking, you know, central bank system. And then the next thing they did was take over the oil reserves. So that's the plan that has been going on again and again. Now, with the Asian elders, they have waited till they were in a position where they have nuclear weapons. So, you know, North Korea is a small country, but it's not being invaded for one good reason, because they have nuclear weapons and nobody wants to go up against that. And, you know, there are two countries. Well, the three countries left on the Bush's so-called axis of evil, none of which had a Rothschild banking system. And there's only General Wesley Clark is on record, and you can see that on the YouTube, where he describes how he went into the Pentagon in early 2001 and was told by a high-ranking officer there, he was shown a document of this plan to invade seven Middle Eastern countries and take over their assets. Well, all of those have been invaded except Iran and Syria, and obviously they're hotspots right now. And then the other part, member of the Axis of Evil, the only other one that hasn't been taken over yet, is North Korea. So China has been waiting until they were in a safe enough position where they wouldn't be attacked, and they could also protect anyone who wanted to ally with them. And then also where the infrastructure was reliable enough that they could begin moving these funds. First of all, just to stabilize the global economy, you know, revalue currencies, forgive tremendous amounts of debt, and move money into humanitarian projects that would actually reform energy and reform justice and restore the environment and so forth. And they've been very actively doing this for years. So we're on the verge of releasing that, as far as we're being told. So when I look to Asia right now, I look for what is their spiritual orientation? How strategic are they in what they're doing? Are they willing to partner rather than dominate? And in all of those categories, they seem to be quite well ahead of the NATO powers right now. So I'm not looking to just do it their way, but I'm thrilled that they want to release this hoarded wealth into the world for humanitarian purposes. And they're, Kimberly and I know from years of research in our Thrive Connect project that virtually every major issue has already been solved, whether it's economy, justice, free energy, decontamination, purification of water, organic agriculture, and so forth. And these projects are out there, but they're being brutally suppressed. And mostly what they need is the money just to finish their project and to protect them and to be safe while they're doing it. So that's the partnership that I'm excited about, not only with Thrive and potential partners from Asia, but humanitarian projects all over the country. And frankly, I invite the Western banking cabal to wake up and participate in that rather than just trying to, you know, to suck up everybody's money and control the world. So that's a long-winded answer, but it was a really important question. Thank you for it.
Thank you, Foster. And I just want to know, are you using China and the Asian family interchangeably, or are they different?
No, they're different, very interlinked, but different. We asked members of the royal family over there, the Dragon family, what's the deal on, you know, communism, and what's the deal on the suppression of Falun Gong and the imprisonment of, you know, so many people who were civil rights activists or whatever. Of course, they've got a lot fewer people in prison than we do. But anyway, we asked them that question, you know, straight on. And they said that the Dragon family is very influential in the government, but they don't, but they aren't the government. That the Dragon family is changing the course of the ship of state over decades and centuries. And they said, look back to Chiang Kai-shek, to Mao, to Deng, to Xi Jinping, and see the direction that it's going. That's what the Dragon family is committed to. And the direction that it's going is like Martin Luther King said about the, you know, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And that's what we're seeing when I study the history of China. And some of the members of the Dragon family have been, you know, sending me videotapes and books and, you know, things to read to understand better their philosophy and their spirituality and their strategy. So I'm really encouraged in terms of the direction that it's going. And, you know, I look forward to global televised live stream conversations where interested activists from the Asian countries, from Western countries, from Southern countries, all over the world will come together and talk through the philosophies and the strategies and the economics of all this in a very open and transparent manner.
Thank you, Foster, and thank you, Kimberly. Bless you both.
Thank you, Brian. You're welcome.
I think we should have one more question and then get on to the hot spots and some of the other topics, because people are interested in all of them, even though if you run out, we should be able to touch on all of them, and we're an hour into this. So maybe Bruce, ask a succinct question and get a succinct answer or not. Whatever, let's see where we go.
Okay. Bruce, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, but we can't see you.
The camera icon is not on view for me.
Oops, you're not very clear.
You're can you get any closer to your microphone?
I'm on the microphone.
Okay.
I can't hear him.
I can't either. Why don't Bruce,
if you're there, go ahead and ask your question. We'll see if we can make it out.
I have it written down here.
Bruce, can you hear us?
I'm gonna read Bruce's question. How about just so shouldn't we at least mention the possibility that the Chinese and Russians are complicit in a long game of global manipulation, i.e. all sock puppets?
Yeah. A great follow-on question. Are you there, Bruce? Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and address the question. If you get your audio working, you're welcome to join in. So again, it's a great question, particularly as a follow-up to Bren's. One of the potential scenarios that we've described in the past is that, you know, at the top levels of banking and government, you know, all of the major nations of the world are covertly in cahoots manifesting as quickly as they can the plans that we described in Thrive for a global domination agenda with the bankers in charge and the government and the military as their enforcement and management arm. So there's a man named J.C. Collins, a very bright guy who does excellent research, who has laid this whole potential scenario out very clearly on the internet. And I've been following him for a long time. And he makes a very compelling case for the fact that when the yuan is accepted into the international bank basket of currencies, then the a currency reset will take place, but it will be simply to empower the use of what are called SDRs, which are special drawing rights. And it's basically an electronic currency that the IMF uses amongst their countries to allot different privileges. And we described in Thrive how part of the plan of the global domination agenda is to move to a one world cashless currency, where those would-be controllers are able to manipulate everybody's wealth based on their behavior, and dissidents wouldn't do well. So it's a very likely scenario that at least an interim step would be that the revaluation of currencies would be done through the IMF. And then the question is, okay, how honest is the revaluation of currencies? How transparent is it? And, you know, can the U.S. continue to inflict its domination through somehow strong-arming the IMF to pretend that the dollar is strong when it's really not? Or will there somehow, particularly because there's so many countries in the powerful countries in the BRICS alliance, will we be moving into a more democratic globe where there's checks and balances from country to country, and the conversation about allotments of currencies and valuations of currencies is done in a more honest way? I predict that that's what's going to happen, and that we need to be very careful that we keep the goal of true freedom in mind, true freedom including free markets and honest currency, and that we make sure in every country that we hold, while there are politicians in charge, we hold their feet to the fire to keep going toward a true free market globally. And that, and people are always asking Kimberly and I, they say, you know, you've studied economics and currencies so much. Well, what is the right one to do? And I learned along the way that that's the wrong question. As soon as you're trying to impose a particular currency, then you're claiming power as a regime, and that's back into the seeds of tyranny. So what we've always recommended is a free market in currencies, just as you have, as you ideally have a free market in trading, you know, whether it's bubblegum or freighters or energy or whatever it is. The mistake that we have made throughout history, in addition to statism, is central planning. An economy in nature is the natural transactions, you know, of light and food and water and soil and all that stuff that are going on all the time, an infinite number of transactions. A human economy would be trillions of voluntary transactions going on every day, and those transactions determine the fair price. And the fair prices determine what is the best use of resources by simple supply and demand. It turns out that whenever that has been given any freedom, people have thrived. It's lifted people out of poverty. The level of living has skyrocketed until the government comes in and tries to take all the you know, to harvest the taxes and control and centrally plan the economy in order to keep their own control. So that's the simple but brutal puppet show that has been going on forever. And now we need to wake up to that. And so, yeah, Bruce's point is a really good one, that it's very likely that at least interimly we would, even though we would have asset-backed currencies, they probably wouldn't be fully asset-backed. There would probably still be fractional reserve, and so therefore, to some extent, fiat money. And we need to keep going in that direction in a way that doesn't just destroy infrastructure and obliterate lives all over the planet, but has a philosophically and morally sound compass keeping going toward the thriving planet that we can have with a true free market and honest currencies all over the planet. Bruce, are you there? Do you have any comments or further questions on that?
No, we couldn't connect with him. I think it's good to move into hotspots.
Okay.
And, you know, also we're available, that comment section in the event page portal for your ongoing questions and comments and stuff. Keep it going, because we'll keep up these conversations in these Thrive Together events as they're of interest to people.
Okay, well, let's talk about war. And I think you probably noticed already that an in-depth discussion of finance and markets and statism, can't help but include at least the risk of, if not the fact of war. So let's look at a few of the hotspots now and unpack at least, you know, my sense of some of what's going on that you may not get in the mainstream. So recently, I think there was a very dangerous situation that you may know of in Korea, where the South Korea, which is an ally of the U.S. and the U.S., was doing military exercises on sea and on land, and very close to North Korea, of course. And North Korea considered that to be very threatening. At the same time, there were loudspeakers set up on the border within South Korea playing anti-North Korea propaganda across the wall or the fence or whatever they have there. And of course, it was obnoxious to the people in North Korea, and very threatening to Kim Jong-un, who's the premier over there. And so because of all of this, the Kim Jong-un started issuing threats. And basically, he said that if those speakers aren't taken out, you know, not turned off, and if the exercises near us are not stopped, we'll have to start launching attacks with what he called, quote, our latest weapons, which the world has never seen. So we still don't know what those are. I don't know if they're real, but I'm really glad that we didn't have to find out at this point, because they do have nuclear weapons, as I mentioned before. What happened was there was a 43-hour dialogue amongst leaders from the North and the South that ended up in a ceasefire. And Kim got his wishes. And so the saber rattling, at least for now, has stopped. He made a point of saying that ceasefire was not a result of the talk, but of the South and the U.S. getting very clear that military might, the increasing military might of Korea would be used if they continued to be threatened, and that's what resolved the dispute. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-un used this whole scenario to get agreement from his people, not that he needs it, but it's convenient, to increase his military budget and develop even more weapons to go with a million-man standing army. So that's Korea. Then nearby there, in the South China Sea, there's all sorts of saber rattling going on there, and, you know, ships threatening each other and planes flying over. It was interesting when Kimberly and I were in China. I decided I wanted to read a Tom Clancy novel because I felt kind of like I was in one. But I also wanted to just, be entertained in my spare time, and I kind of get a sense of some of the dramas of that area. So it was a novel that actually took place in mostly in Hong Kong, but was all about growing threats between the U.S. and China over the South China Sea. So it was really uncanny to read it because this was written about 3 or 4 years ago, and it was exactly what's going on now. What mostly this comes down to is that the South China Sea is one of the seven top choke points for freighters carrying oil to countries around the world. The U.S. I think currently controls something like five of them, and the other two they are the South China Sea. Now the South China Sea is open right now, so they've got free access, but they're very afraid that China will shut it down, and China is very afraid that the U.S. will, in an emergency situation, take it over to cut off the flow of oil from various countries to China. So that basically is still going on. When we were in China, most of the headlines were about the military threats going on from one country to another in the South China Sea. It's backed off a little bit out of the headlines, but it's still a very real hot point. I'll just mention briefly, it wasn't on the list, but the other choke point that's really under dispute right now is in the Gulf of Aden and the Strait of what they call Bab el Mandab. And more than 10% of the world's seaborne petroleum passes through this choke point. And the U.S. has basically controlled it through dominating the government of President Hadi in Yemen. Well, there's been a coup recently that has taken Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi out of power and replaced him with someone that the U.S. Apparently does not have control over. So the U.S. is partnering with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Morocco, Sudan, Jordan, and others against Iran, who's supporting the rebels, and of course the rebels themselves. So that again is a huge hot point, which goes back to the economics of keeping sea lanes open for free transactions in oil, and the statists who would like to take over all that in order to control oil, in order to control people. So let's look for a minute at Ukraine. Once again, Ukraine is mostly about the status wanting to have weapons in place, the U.S. wanting to have NATO weapons placed on the borders of as close as possible to Russia. And of course, Russia doesn't want to have that. So Russia has been willing to call bluffs in Crimea and continuing now in Ukraine. Many of you probably have heard the recording. This surveillance thing kind of goes both ways sometimes. Someone got a recording of Victoria Nuland pushing of the U.S., pushing for the installation of Petro Poroshenko, who's now the head of Ukraine, the U.S. put him in an overthrow of Viktor Yanukovych. And all of this is to basically suppress the Ukrainian population so they can hopefully control the oil supplies between Russia, Crimea, other states over to Europe. Russia is standing its ground. And, if Russia was putting in missiles on the border with Mexico and Canada, I think we'd have a much clearer feeling what the what Russia is going through in relation to this. And it's this is part of the attempt to antagonize Russia to keep their economy weak and disempower not only Russia, but the BRICS alliance itself. So obviously, and then there's, you know, the shooting down of jets and all of them. They're going to go into all the various false flags, things that are going on. Almost always these things are not what they're reported to be, and their attempts to make the enemy look bad to justify either sanctions, collapsing their economy, or starting war. And then let's look at finally just at Syria for a moment, because it's obviously a really hot one. I mentioned that Syria was one of those seven countries that the U.S. had planned to, you know, disrupt and take over. I think the key element here is for people to understand that there was a memo in 2012 to the White House that was willfully ignored, and in the report of a former DIA chief named Michael Flynn, and he claims that this was willfully ignored, and he basically goes on to say that ISIS is in fact a U.S. manufactured military asset, like Al Qaeda, which was originally created by the U.S. through the CIA in order to fight, you know, Russia in Afghanistan. This is a similar situation where ISIS is actually created and funded and weaponized by the U.S. Now there's evidence by the U.K. also that's meant to distract a global American population, and whose inherent violence can be directed to realize U.S. foreign policy goals of destabilization, not only of the Middle East, but of North Africa, and now through the whole refugee crisis and so forth in Southeastern Europe as well. All of this to not only control the banking system, take the gold and take over the resources, but to also open a doorway for NATO to enter all these regions in force as they're trying to do in Ukraine. One interesting note, this is not critical, but I found it really interesting. I just saw this a couple of days ago. The Bill Gates and Syngenta and Monsanto and others, the ones who are pushing GMOs on the rest of the world, they created this doomsday seed vault. It's the largest organic seed vault in the world, in under the ice, in the permafrost in Norway. And it's saved for major, like, nuclear catastrophe or something like that, supposedly. That seed vault was just opened for the first time a few days ago to get certain drought-resistant seeds to be taken into Syria to try to help with the food crisis there. Okay, we could talk, if people are interested, we could talk about the refugee crisis in Europe too, but I think there's been so much coverage of that. I don't want to take more time right now. I want to find out what your opinions are, what you want to talk about specifically. So I think that I will leave it there.
Okay, and also I know we had lined up Foster, Preston, and people to participate here also. I wanted to make one comment about the interface of these two subjects, because one of the things about the U.S., and some of the people really clearly wanting war as a distraction for what's really going on here and the role that war plays in the U.S. economy. But as the world is moving away from the dollar and pretty much siding with China and the BRICS countries, you could see that when the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the U.S. was like warning the U.K. and others not to participate, and still there are 57 countries who joined against the advice of the U.S. in doing that. And in addition, with Russia and China and a number of countries now trading oil and other commodities not using the dollar, I think what's happening is that people are not going with the bully in the same way anymore. And I really personally don't see the U.S. having the kind of international support that they would need to carry out a war. I think it's still risky, obviously, but I think that the place that these two things interface is that as the economy, as people are waking up to the economy, I think that that's helping them to recognize that they might not want to participate in something like that that the U.S. is initiating. So that's one of the places that I personally have my hope in this, is that I think as the as our role in the world changes, the good part of that is that we can't just snap our fingers and get allies to participate in these wars.
Yeah, let me, go ahead.
The other thing I wanted to say that I've learned to do now is to follow the money and the gold. In any country where there's any talk of war, to just realize, like one of the things that happened for us in China, and as Foster's really been diving into the history of China and the Philippines and Vietnam, and is seeing the role of gold and money in the wars that, that we've had and in the wars that are threatened. So I just took that Yamashita's gold, I dropped it into the, I put a link to it. So did Sky, thank you for that. But I think it's really helpful as a way to kind of track that.
Yeah, let me add one thing to that, just kind of in summary, because it really brings the finances and the wars together with this whole, these scenarios that we've been laying out. There's a lot of debate now, particularly in the financial media, about when is the Federal Reserve going to raise interest rates. The interest rates are basically at zero, so people, you know, aren't making any money on their money, and the government is pretending that the price of borrowing money is actually zero, which is completely ridiculous. That would never work in a viable economy. And again, Peter Schiff and many other people said there's no way they're going to be able to raise the interest rates, even though in the last meeting the markets thought they were going to. And Peter Schiff basically made the case that if they raise the interest rates any significant amount at all, then it will expose the insolvency of the U.S. government and all of the major banks in a way that would just lead to collapse, lack of confidence in the government, all of that. And so then the other thing is, will they start QE again? Will they start printing money again? Because those are basically, when you're trying to decentralize the planning of the government, those are your two main implements, is printing money or raising or lowering interest rates. And it seems like the U.S. has backed themselves into a corner where they're not allowed to do QE according to the Dragon family. We'll see if that ends up being valid. And they don't want to raise interest rates because it would shoot themselves in the foot. So what's the alternative to those two? Well, historically, it's been war. If you go to a war, then you can declare martial law. Obama already did an executive order called the National Resources Defense Act, I think, where in the times of emergency, either military or financial emergency, he gave himself, the executive branch, the right to take over the internet, to take over the economy, to take over transportation, manufacturing, and so basically become a total dictator. So under those circumstances, he might be able to claim power if he could figure out some way to pay his soldiers, to try to desperately hang on to control rather than partner with the rest of the world. And that's one of the reasons why I'm following so closely these global hotspots, because as Kimberly mentioned, when he tried to go in to attack Syria, even the Congress stood up and said no, much less the American people. It was like over 90%. It had been over 70% with Iraq, but it was so overwhelming that it's getting harder to do that. So it's up to each one of us to keep getting educated and inform our networks and make sure that we protest in every way possible against turning one of these false flag things into a world war.
All right. Should we have some of the questions on this come in?
Yeah, let's take one or two questions on this topic, and then I have some other topics from our portal page and a couple of other people I'd like to bring in.
All right, so let's go for Alex with the Iran nuclear deal, and then, there's so much to say here. Let's see.
While Alex is being brought up, I just want to say, David Morgan, I saw that you were going to be on the call. If, in fact, you're with us today, and would be willing to share a few minutes with it of your perspective on the precious metals market and how it's related to what we're talking about so far. David has written a phenomenal history of gold and the Federal Reserve, the precious metals, especially silver, and the history of the Federal Reserve and so forth. And he's one of the gurus that I go to for in-depth wisdom in the precious metals area. So, David, if you're with us and would be willing to share at some point, we'd love to have you come on.
Let's do that. Let's go for Alex, then David, and then Preston. Should we do it like that and then get to the other? We still have the other subjects and some more questions. So everyone has time to succinct. Okay. Hi, Alex.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. We can't see you, but I guess that's the nature of the day.
Yeah, I'm listening to you guys through my phone and watching on the computer. So
okay,
I don't think we're going to have video. But I've heard, obviously, both positions regarding the Iran nuclear deal. And I was curious as to your opinion on it, whether it's good, bad, or irrelevant, if it's not really doing anything at all, just your general take.
Okay. Kimberly, you have anything, or do you want me to go on that? Well, the first activism I was ever involved in was I was a spokesperson for the Nuclear Freeze Initiative back in the early 70s. I think it's the single most important issue on the planet because it can take out the planet in a matter of minutes. So my own strong belief is that no one on the surface of planet Earth should be able to have nuclear weapons because of the risk that it poses to everyone else. And therefore, under what I think is the prime directive for a thriving humanity, which is the non-aggression principle, I think the mere possession of nuclear weapons is a violation of the security of all other species. So I don't think they should be allowed to anyone. The second thing I would say is the notion that the U.S., the only country that has ever used nuclear weapons in wars, would be able to go around and tell other countries who can and can't have it is the height of hypocrisy to me, and especially since that's being driven by Israel. And I can understand them, Israel not wanting to be attacked with nuclear weapons by a neighbor. But Israel has nuclear weapons, so all of their neighbors are just as afraid of that, and they've pretended for 40 years that they don't have them, and everybody who's done any research knows that they have them. So it is an emperor has no clothes puppet show of the grandest order, and I think that the whole nuclear weapons thing is a complete charade to create an excuse to get in and destabilize Iran, take over their economy, take over their oil, and mitigate any threat to Israel.
Okay, so can we expect this being maybe a first phase of a predetermined rollout of events to come, or no?
What being the first phase?
The nuclear.
The passing of the Iran nuclear deal, you said that it is a sham to facilitate us getting into Iran particularly. So can we look for, is the next step of another war, or what do you see coming in the future?
Yeah, well, Obama, to his credit, did not just try to go in and bomb. There's the John McCain's of the world right now who would be bombing Iran tomorrow if they were in charge. So I'm grateful that there's some sense of at least making a treaty that postpones things. The notion that we should have the power to demand that they agree not to develop nuclear weapons when we've got them. And, some people are pushing for that they wouldn't even be able to develop nuclear power. It's kind of a secondary hypocrisy to me, but yes, I think that those different camps will still be going toward immobilizing Iran, decimating their economy, or actually trying to start war there. And I think that, you know, the real hawks would like to use ISIS as an excuse to further bomb Syria and then just not be just bombing so-called ISIS, but to actually bomb the regime and then expand that into Iran. Yeah, I think they absolutely want to do that, not only to try to control the region according to the global domination agenda, but to try to distract from and postpone this losing of power to a global financial system that is in partnership rather than dominated by the U.S. What do you think? What's your sense of it?
Well, I try to talk to people whose opinions I value and kind of compile my own opinion. I heard briefly about its, I guess, the ability for the U.S. to come in and look into the facilities that would be, you know, a red flag, so to speak, for the U.S. government, and that there's a 24 or 20-some day wait time on that, and that was a lot of the hubba-bubba between the Republicans and the Democrats. That's at least what I took away from it, and yeah. I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how seductive it is to get caught up in the minutiae of politics and treaties and not kind of step back and look and see, wait a minute, what's actually going on here? Why are we even involved? That, you know, those type of questions are what interest me more in the long run. But thanks for your question. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for taking it.
And also, thank you for your approach of looking at various sources that you find at least to some degree reliable and then making up your own mind. That is music to my ears. And we'll be talking in just a few minutes with one of a brilliant young guy in the network named Preston Bates, who's been making incredible developments on blockchain-based secure news feeds that hopefully through him and his team will be available to all of us soon to really facilitate that kind of information gathering and critical thinking.
And the awareness that is the solution, because when you understand what ISIS is, then we don't respond in an emotional reaction and empower these, you know, horrible moves based on something that isn't true, and we understand the manipulation. So our awareness is key here, and it's one of the things that we do have the benefit of is just hearing from, you know, thousands and thousands of people around the world who are awake to what's actually going on, and including increasing numbers of Americans who are awake. So, you know, we don't see that on the mainstream news, but it is, in fact, happening. Anyway, let's go for David and Preston, and then we have more topics. And I think current events is a good one, judging from this. I want to just carry on some of these conversations in upcoming events. But anyway, go for it. Who do we have, David or Preston?
David, do you have a camera?
I do. It's not working. I mean, it's not showing anything. Maybe it will now.
There's a little icon to the right of your name that's green that has like a little, looks like a fish or a video. Next to a hand and a.
Dave is also, looks like he's coming in through a mobile device, so that his interface might be a little bit
different. Oh, okay.
I'm on a computer now, but I do just have the laptop going because.
Okay.
All right, well, let's just go for it anyway. It's a pleasure to have you here, even if it's just your voice.
Well, thank you.
So, David, any input that you have on where precious metals fit in with this whole thing or any other reflections on its finance and the global dramas would be welcome.
Well, thank you. I'll try to be succinct. It's tough. I look, as you read the book, Foster, you know, the last chapter is Beyond Silver. I look at the precious metals as the only honest money available. It's been that way throughout history. And they haven't lost that status. So when I look at silver and gold pretty much as a transitionary phase that is going to be coveted by people in the know, people that are on this channel, people that have watched the Thrive movement and get what's really happening in the global political sphere. So because of that, you know, we've tried to make some solutions. One of them is a precious metals debit card. But specifically, what's going on right now has got me baffled. I've been in the precious metals and the honest money movement for more than 40 years. And right now, to buy silver from any dealer is a huge spread, a huge markup from what the paper price is on the exchanges. So you have to pay somewhere like 20% or so, in some cases even higher, and wait 4, 6, 8, sometimes 12 weeks. And this isn't just your retail dealer on the internet in your hometown. This is government mints across the board with exception of Australia. So it's the United States government mint, it's the Canadian mint, and these entities are having a difficult time meeting demand. So it feels different to me this time. I like to stay grounded. I don't like to be too hypey. I like to tell the truth and base most of my stuff on fact. But you also have these, you know, sixth sense or feels for the market, especially when you've been in a certain market for so long. So I think we're getting to the point now with this paper paradigm or this fiat Ponzi scheme that's been perpetrated on everybody on a global basis through the banking elite is starting to unravel even faster. And the only way I know through history study to protect yourself is to have some precious metals. And I emphasize the word some. It's not imperative that you sell everything and buy gold. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is be open-minded and understand that the financial survival is as important as perhaps your other survival, but it's not the only thing. You must maintain balance in this. Any questions?
One of the things that blew my mind in your book, why don't you say the name of the book for everybody?
Sure. It's called The Silver Manifesto. It's available on Amazon, and we just finally got the audio version done.
Great. And if at some point you can drop a link in the chat for people to go directly, that would be great. One of the things that blew my mind in that book was the way you traced out the history, especially in China, where they have been so aware for thousands of years of the value of precious metals. David's got graphs in this book showing four different dynasties. These are like, you know, 500 to 1,000 year dynasties or more that thrived financially until they went into fiat money. And then fiat money killed every single one of them. And you see the graph just drop off the cliff, just like it has in the U.S. since 1913.
Absolutely, and well said. I mean, the whole idea for the human race, I mean, it's a human problem. This isn't just, you know, what race we are or where we live on the planet. These are human problems. And the way that we get along best is by having integrity and honesty. And the precious metals have those inherently built into them. And because of that fact, you get, and excuse me overusing the word, you have a more thriving environment because you can trust each other and what you're going to settle in. Right now, the system is settled basically because you have more weaponry or more power, as you alluded to on the first part of the call. You know, China dropped their currency and all of a sudden there's this explosion that takes place. Are they connected? I don't know, but they certainly happened in a very small time frame.
Right.
I have a question about carat bars, K-A-R-A-T. Bars. I have been interacting with somebody on my blog about a way for people who don't have much money to participate in precious metals. Clearly, they're, you know, a third of the country lives paycheck to paycheck. Most people don't have investment money. So, but what about ways for people who don't have investment money to participate, and specifically about carat bars? Do you know about that?
Yeah, I do, and I'm favorable to it. Basically, I'm like Foster. I think the best currency system is a competitive currency system. Okay. I'm not saying that the precious metals are the only way to go. I'm not real onto the Bitcoin situation, but I don't have the arrogance to say it's wrong or it should be this one or the other one. So, Kimberly, I think that's a good one. As I said, I typed it into everyone that we have. It's not me, actually. It's a friend of mine that has a precious metals debit card. Unfortunately, it's only available in the U.S. right now, but it's a very low premium. It operates like any debit card, so there's a way to hold precious metals outside of the banking system, but the cash side of the card, like any debit card, is in the banking system, but it's sort of a hybrid. But yes, Kimberly, there's lots of ways to do it. And the thing I like more about silver than gold is it's more affordable. I mean, silver is something that most average working people can squeak out, you know, maybe saving even $5 a week or $10 a week or something like that. And if they're getting the habit of saving something of real value that's showing that over time, then, you know, it's something that could be a benefit for them, you know, present day or future date.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for coming on, David, and let us know when the audiobook is ready also. You saved me so much time ongoingly, and I want to share that with the whole network when it comes out.
Yeah, thank you. So let's bring up Preston.
Yeah, David mentioned Bitcoin, and Bitcoin, for those of you who saw the blog that Goa and Rob from our team did a few weeks ago on Bitcoin, you know, the whole thing is based on this blockchain idea, you know, this electronic trail that provides transparency and therefore reliability to Bitcoin, at least to a certain extent. So it's one of the things that intrigued us when we were approached by Preston Bates, who's coming on now, about a development that he was doing in relation to bringing the same kind of reliability to honesty in media. So Preston, are you there?
Hi, Foster and Kimberly. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can even see you.
All right, great. I'm wearing my feed shirt.
All right. That's great.
I just want to say, yes, sir. Thank you guys for taking so much leadership and getting the Thrive documentary published to millions of people in so many different languages. It inspired the solution I've worked on, and so I would be remiss if I didn't thank you and say what a service it is. The problem I'm trying to solve is that the information economy has some bottlenecks and kinks in it, and it's not really a free-flowing, fluid topology, if you will, or there's some problems. For one, the live reporting platform that Twitter produced, although making the friction of sharing information, reporting, releasing that friction, making it easier, the consequence has been that it's tough to verify information, and it's tough to sort what's true and what's not, or even find breaking information because there's just so much. So that's one problem we were trying to solve. At the highest level, we really want to speed up information markets by improving the robustness of the primary information goods, so that reporters don't have to do the job of a copy editor, reporter, fact checker, and storyteller or relator, but can simply make meaningful, consistent, objective-based stories. And so we do that. The blockchain element, we're fusing a prediction market that is blockchain-based so that people can get economic incentives for sharing breaking information. They can predict that something live breaking is happening, and then when people verify the report, that person's trust score goes up, and that person can even be financially rewarded. So I see it as a way for us to really just unshackle the wisdom and the local information that Hayek talked about that we all have, and hopefully approach faster, better journalism that's truly unbiased. So this project's in development, has been for about a year, and I'd be happy to talk to answer questions from anybody. I'm grateful for the opportunity to share.
Great. And if you could drop your website into chat also. Does anybody have a question for Preston now?
Preston, do you have a headset that you could wear to minimize the just kind of...
You guys getting some background?
Some sort of static.
Yeah, there's a lot of static.
Let me see here. 1 second. It's you can go if you sound like you're either a news junkie or you would share information, report yourself. I would love it if you could go to www.feeds.co, feeds with a Z, sign up so I can get your input and help make this product better and more usable before it's released. So that would be fantastic. Let me try this next step. Is that at all better?
Let's see when you get it in.
Say something again.
Is this better?
No, we still have that static, but it's workable.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't see any questions yet for Preston, and we've got several other that we want to get to. So maybe we ought to leave it at that for now.
I think what we should do, though, make sure to drop that in and people follow up, because this notion of, I really see that our awareness is the solution here, because as we see what's going on, we don't fall prey. I mean, I traveled recently. I always pick up every magazine I don't normally pay attention to when I'm traveling. And if I didn't know better, I would think, you know, China's in a really struggling role and that's why the Fed didn't increase the interest rates. I mean, it's so challenging to actually be informed. So these new emerging ways for us to get information and to be able to tell whether or not it's accurate is just such a fabulous breath of fresh air. So I really appreciate it. Drop it in, and people, you really can interact personally with feedback and get a, you know, get something that works for you. So I encourage that. So we have 10 minutes and we still have more subjects that we listed on our infographic that we haven't even touched into and more questions. So
Kimberly, I'd love to take a moment to address a couple of questions from our event page.
Okay.
I really like to reward people who put questions on our event page. For those of you who don't know where that is, if you go to Thrive Together and just click on the event poster, the infographic, it'll take you to the page. And we always invite people to put questions that they would like to get considered or comments on that page, and we try to bring them up as much as possible. So Sky dropped in a number of comments. We don't have the time to address them all, but a couple of them were around the area of seems like almost every article and video I find about how to deal with financial crises are directed toward those who have expendable income. Those of us who are poverty stricken need to know what to do too. And that's, yeah, as Kimberly said, you know, at least a third of the people in this country and worse in other countries are in that situation. So it's a critical one. In terms of the whole precious metals issue, through silver and through something like carat bars, it's now possible, even if you can put aside over time $500 and then turn that into precious metals, it won't just disappear from your bank account like it happened in Greece and other countries. So that's one thing you can do. I would say the main thing, Kimberly and I were kind of brainstorming this one last night. The main thing is build community. Whether it's your local community surrounding you or an online community or the network of people interested in similar issues, make sure that you are in relationship with people so that in particularly in case of crisis, you can pool resources. You can pool information. You can pool food, water, protection, all sorts of things that come through community that people might not be able to afford themselves. Also, if you don't have one already, or you may have one partially, spend whatever free time you can working on building a needed skill and train yourself up in that skill, whether it's bookkeeping or online salesmanship or data entry or some craft or an art that you have a propensity for, you know, skill as a nanny or, get yourself fit and then you can hire yourself out as a personal trainer. Make sure your driver's license and record is intact and, you know, apply to drive for Uber. There's a whole lot of things like that. And again, if other people have suggestions for steps that people can take to protect themselves from the sort of things that are probably coming, as well as just to boost their level of living and their well-being, drop those into chat as well. Kimberly, anything to add to that?
No, I thought, I've lots to add to that, but I'm just looking at the time. I think bring up the other question because I thought it was really, there was another question there. And also, I just want to say, Sky, you have so many good questions that you put in here, and I know we need to move into the other topic, so I'm not going to go for them this time, but I just honor, I love your questions, and we will get to more of them. So
I'll just say in 30 seconds, this guy asked whether or not anyone had initiated legal proceedings against the global banking cabal, and what have the outcomes been so far? As far as I know, the only one who's done it is this guy Neil Keenan, who filed a trillion-dollar lawsuit against the banking cabal for all sorts of things, including the suppression of the cashing in of these what they call the historical bonds, where people have access and are owed gold or cash in relation to the Dragon family's loaning money out for many decades, and that has been suppressed. So he filed a trillion-dollar lawsuit, and it's still in the courts. It hasn't it's generated a lot of publicity, not much action yet. It's tough to do that in courts that are run by the very people you're suing.
Let's go for Ray's. There was a question from.
Okay, Ray Gale sent in a question. He said, so many predictions seem to be focused on late September of 2015, global currency revaluation, collapse of the U.S. stock market, planet Nibiru, asteroid strike, El Nino, human consciousness shift, new frequency alignment of the planets, to name a few. Can you discuss what you think might be causing so much focus on this time frame? Well, I certainly don't know, but these are some of the thoughts that came to my mind. First of all, it's the most common time of the year for market crashes. The banking elite has come back from summer vacation. It's not yet their Christmas vacation. They basically shut down in August, and they shut down from December like 1st or to January 15th, something like that. So it's a good time kind of at the end of the year where they're doing their tax planning and so forth, where they can actually do their manipulated stock crashes. And that also fits in with, I don't know if any of you have been following this whole notion of the Shemitah. And this is a whole notion in the Hebrew world. It's a biblical seven-year cycle where there's kind of a reckoning. Oftentimes there's a jubilee, but there's also a reckoning. And it's interesting to note that we're right in the September 13th this year, was the date of the Shemitah. Things tend to happen before and after that. Jeff Berwick has done a fabulous video on this. It's online. Just look up Jeff Berwick and Shemitah. I don't remember the exact title, but it'll inform you about a lot of the history. But the last one was September 29th, 2008, 7 years ago exactly, which is when that crash happened. Go 7 years before that, September 17th, 2001, the Dow dropped 684 points, and obviously the what I think is a false flag operation around 9/11 happened as well. Go back 70 years, seven times times 10 was when the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan. So it's an auspicious time of year, especially I think for secret societies. Also, the IMF 2010 reforms, which have been agreed to by everyone except the United States, which would really free up this global currency reset. The U.S. got an extension last December to go till the end of 2015. So there's that extended pressure on the U.S. to take action of some sort. Tomorrow is this double blood moon. I'm not an astronomer, but I gather this is a really big deal. Also, where the moon is the closest that it's going to be in 30 years, and the global elite tend to do auspicious things around the full moon as well as numerically auspicious dates. This is the 70th anniversary of the UN, so most of the global leaders, and including the Pope and Putin and Xi Jinping, and a lot of the major players are all in either New York or Washington right now, and they're meeting with each other. And when there are these auspicious state occasions, you hear the formal addresses for the public, but behind the scenes is when these people or their agents meet to make the transactions in person that they don't want to do over electronic media, and actually, come to agreements on things, shake hands, and then inform the public much later on. Today through tomorrow is this whole UN conference, which is not only celebrating the 70th anniversary of the UN, but which is being used to launch Agenda 2030. Agenda 21 just expired, and this is their new updated global version, and it's horrifying. It, you know, if you read it, we just put up a post on our Facebook page yesterday, I think, where an analysis of the 17 points. But this is basically where the global elite are using all of our concerns about the environment to get in place a one world government. For a one world government, you need the laws that transcend national sovereignty and the taxes where this new entity gets to tax the entire world themselves and then enforce it by NATO. We, you know, we covered that in Thrive. Yesterday is when it was presented to the UN. Supposedly it's been signed by all of the countries in the UN. It's not binding. It's not a legal document. It's what they call an expression of intent with the weight of coercion. It's literally their words for it. Really what they're trying to do is move this thing into law in November at the Paris Environmental Conference. So those are some of many things that are all, you know, Jade Helm just ending at this time, to whatever degree that was in preparation for what's coming, I don't know. So I don't know why, but it seems to me a convergence of a lot of things, some of which are natural, some of which are intentionally coordinated to align with those natural things. But bottom line to me, all of it is the evidence of intent of the global elite and their secret societies to establish a one world government, the new world order.
Yeah. We didn't get to half of what we intended today for our event. I think what we should do, because those, so we took a poll. These were the ones that were the most popular, but there were others with plenty of people who wanted to talk about it. And we have lots that we've been thinking about and to share and want to hear more and engage your good questions. So I propose that we have another current events event. For, I guess, our next one. Oh, we have upcoming events to tell you about that are going to be good and hot. We have October 24th. We're going to be talking about climate change and the economics of climate change, and have, you know, really have an open-minded, respectful consideration of different viewpoints and understand and unpack more of what some of the incentives are for the different viewpoints. So we really encourage you October 24th to come to that. And then we have these a blog on October 10th that's gonna be interesting on just really defining terms so that we understand better what it is we're talking about when someone says they're a social democrat or a...
Let me read one paragraph from the introduction to that blog to give people a sense of why I'm doing it. It goes like this, adding to the alienation people tend to experience is the fact that we don't even have a clear definition of the terms we use to discuss political topics. Among the front runners, Bernie Sanders is a self-proclaimed socialist, an independent social democrat, while Donald Trump was a Democrat, turned conservative Republican, calls himself a capitalist. Rand Paul is a libertarian Republican. So what in the world do these terms actually mean? So what we've done in that blog is literally define about a dozen terms that will take your discussions to a whole different level, because 43% of the young people in the U.S. now think socialism is a great thing, even though it's led to hundreds of millions of deaths just in the last century alone. So we're in a very dangerous situation when people think, you know, people can still be duped into thinking that socialism just means what the politicians say it means, which is, oh, we're just going to take care of people. Of course, we all want to take care of people. But unless we understand history on this one, we're going to be doomed to repeat it. And that's very dangerous. So tune in for that blog next week.
Yeah. And so we will get to these other questions. We'll create an event to do that. I'm sorry we didn't today, but it felt like a fruitful event with what we did cover. Really appreciate what an informed and engaged and thoughtful, solution-oriented network this is. And a lot of negative stuff got covered, and I just want to remind everybody that our awareness and our connections with people really are the solution. Whether you have money to invest or not, I think being aware of what's going on and having peace in your heart and connections to people is really what it's all about. And so this is our contribution toward that, and we are inspired by you and deeply heartened by these gatherings. So thank you.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, everyone, and a special thanks to Goa and to Rob and to Mitch, who you don't get to see very often, but they're on all these calls working feverishly behind the scenes to make things, make sure everything runs as smoothly as possible. And thanks to all of you who showed up for today's event and you know, hundreds more who will come in to watch this in the archive. This is what makes it all possible. Thank you.
Keep the comments going. So we'll drop links in there also on the portal page.
Okay, Goa, why don't you open it up so everybody can say goodbye to each other for a minute.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, folks. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Please make a blog. Explaining the difference between the Chinese government, the Asian elders, and the dragon family. Too much confusion.
Come on.
Oh, that we seem to have some feedback on that with maybe too many people today.
Okay. All right. Thanks, everyone. Cheers.
Bye.